Welcome to an episode of Bridging the Bones, a podcast where we explore the causes, context, and possible solutions to conflict. I am your host, Sodaline Wang. On the one hand, you're saying that you experienced something divine, and you experienced God as a homeless dropout from Colombia while taking acid. And some people will hear that. This is the second of a two-part conversation with Jesse Clark, who is releasing segments of their memoir titled A Life in Stories by Jesse Clark in podcast form this September 2025. Please be aware that some words and themes from this discussion are not suitable for all audiences. From what we were talking about earlier, you were in Colombia, right? And then you had dropped out of Colombia.
Yeah. After I took acid.
74?
After I took acid for a year in the spring of 75, it was in my sophomore year, I dropped out of school and I went home to live with, well, by that time, my mother had moved. She had lived in California where she was a free love hippie acid head. And she came back to Washington, D.C. in the 70s. And she lived in a hippie commune near DuPont Circle. So
in D.C.
In Washington, D.C., yeah. So I went home, as it were. But my father lived still in that plantation house out in Maryland, and I wanted to go back to my friends that I still had, a smattering of friends from junior high school and so on that I had stayed in touch with. So I wanted to live in Washington. So I tried to go live at my mother's house, but it turned out there was no room in the inn, and I ended up sleeping on a piece of plywood with some foam rubber on it, with two milk crates in the dining room / living room, where they kept the refrigerator. So I was basically homeless and taking acid quite often. And I started tripping out. I was just like, and then my mother was mentally ill.
I understand why you would start smoking.
Marijuana.
What was your impetus to be taking acid?
Oh, as I said, I had been, first off, it was common cultural phenomena. It was 1960s, early 70s, acid was widely available. And you know, Timothy Leary.
Why also drop out, though?
Oh, well, the school was a real disappointment. The housing was wretched. The dormitories were just horrible. The property was decaying. The school was on hard times. New York City was going bankrupt, and the garbage men went on strike, and it reeked. And then the Bronx was on fire, and the air was really polluted. And I was a good student, but I wasn't interested in anything that they were teaching, really. So I was interested in, but I didn't have any career ambitions or aspirations.
I think some of the listeners who would have no recollection of the 1960s and 70s, I mean, for them, and many of whom have been working for all their adult lives, or most of their adult lives, starting at 18 or even younger, that was a very different place economically.
Well, I got my first job when I was 14 at a restaurant, and then I worked summer at a gas station, and then I worked at a print shop where I was a bindery worker, and then I liked printing, so I actually I got another job in print shop, and actually I had gotten a job. I got my old job back when I came back to my mother's house, but anyway, I didn't see really why I was getting a bachelor's degree. There wasn't any particular reason to do it, and I could just go get a job and take acid on the weekends.
I guess what I'm getting at is, if there's probably a question in mind of some people, was it the acid that demotivated you, or were you not,
Oh, that's a good question.
or was there something else? I mean,
Well,
because
oh yeah.
there were a lot of things going on, sure,
That's true.
during the 1960s and 70s. There were a lot of people who were, being killed. But was there some particular impetus
The
for the LSD to become a more than experimental experience?
Oh yeah, I think so, because like I said, I had read a lot of books about it. So I was looking for a religious experience and I started having religious experiences. However, I didn't really have the framework to interpret them because, I had the ca understanding of a 10-year-old or 11-year-old Catholic kid in terms of spirituality and religion. And I didn't have a community of people who had similar beliefs at that time. So I was a lost soul, as it were. And, the other thing was my housing situation was just horrible. They had a housing shortage, and so I lived in a triple. They put three kids in a room,
Okay.
and a room that was designed for maybe two. And so I had absolutely no privacy, and I had an obnoxious, very obnoxious roommate who stayed up late. And so even if I wanted to study, I couldn't really study in my own room. The living conditions were miserable, and the men that went to that school, the pre-med students were competitive and vicious, and the pre-law students were arrogant and pushy, and the prep school kids were entitled and rude, and the hippies, they sat around and took drugs. So I joined in with the hippies sitting around taking drugs, but I was a lot more serious. I wanted to see God. I want to understand the universe.
Let's cut to a recorded excerpt of Jesse's memoir. Here they find themselves couch surfing after having dropped out of college. They are experiencing intense nightmares when sleeping on their brother's sofa despite having stopped taking acid. They return to a church at Columbia University to seek help from a Catholic priest.
And I step into the gates, Columbia at 116th and Broadway, and I see the South Lawn where we had that be-in, that smokeout, where I first dropped acid on what had turned out to be Good Friday last spring. It's a cold, overcast day today. Then it was warm and sunny when I first glimmered a God in the stained glass at St. John's Cathedral. I head across the cobblestones past the sundial, and I start up the stairs past Low Library, heading towards St. Paul's Chapel. I wonder if I can make it over to 110th Street, see the stained glass again. I'm here to see the counselor, school counselor, who's a priest. I have an hour to kill because I'm early. So I retrace my steps to the Cathedral of St. John the Divine. And when I go in, it's like my first trip here earlier, but everything's different now. I'm primed. Yeah, I lean back in the same pew I sat in before. I look at the west stained glass. I see 16 panels. There's the apostles. There's Mary Magdalene washing Jesus' feet. There's Simon denying Jesus before the cock crows. There's Judas counting his silver. There's Thomas feeling the shape of Christ's wounds. I love these familiar images of my childhood. I don't really understand them, but I get a great primordial sense of peace. And I breathe deep. I'm ready to go see the priest. Now, Father Larry, he's a young Jesuit who serves as a counselor for the Catholic kids at the university. I've found him, and he's agreed to give me counseling. He's got tight, curly hair. Black frame glasses. He's a hip version. He wears a hip version of the Roman Catholic collar with a casual sports jacket and jeans. And his name is La, it's Italian. It's I don't remember his last name, but he told me, he tells me, call him Father Larry. So, you know, I want to talk about God, the meaning of life, sexuality, gender. Oh yeah, about the nightmares. I have horrible, horrible nightmares. That's the other thing I forgot to mention, is that at night, I have terrifying visions of being brutalized, raped, and tortured. I can't sleep. Anyway, I dive in. No, I can't decide if I have a mission from God or if I'm imagining that I have this mission from God. I say, Larry, the Father Larry asks, what feeling is this? Well, it's sort of an ocean being. It surrounds us all. We're all interconnected fronds, seaweed. We're pushed by waves that we can't see. And what about these nightmares? Yes. Oh, there's a darkness. It's a darkness. It's ready to suck me up, and it connects me to an inextinguishable fountain of rage that's boiling up like lava from an undersea volcano. Larry keeps asking me questions, roaming through my inner universe. I'm trying to get him to grapple with my vision of God and get him to tell me if I'm really seeing God and am I chosen. He's drilling down on some more practical questions. Now, and I try to bring it back around to my quest to know God. Maybe I can even become a priest, I say. But then I ask him the question, I say, but can a Catholic vocation be compatible with homosexuality? Father Larry blushes. I mean transsexuality, I stutter, and he blushes even deeper. That's a deep question. That's a deep question. It's not about who you are, it's about your behavior. And he manages to wander off into some Jesuitical reasoning about sexuality and Catholicism, and then he lands back squarely in his role as counselor. Now, how long have you been having these feelings? He collects some more history. Where am I living? Do I have a job? Am I coming back to school? I strike out on all those questions. Have you been taking drugs? He blurts. No, I haven't. He looks at me skeptically. Suddenly, I feel like I'm back in the confessional at Blessed Sacrament Church. It's been 6 weeks since I took acid, Father. Now he looks serious. You've been tripping with no drugs for 6 weeks. Yeah. You need to see a medical doctor. Maybe. He looks at his watch. Where are you staying tonight? That's an excerpt from Turning Point in My Life.
And how was this a turning point? I mean, aside from going back to school.
Well, I continued to get so-called counseling from Father Larry, and basically he towed the Catholic line that sexual deviance was a sin, and if the mind had a condition, as long as the behavior was consistent with God's commandments, then it wasn't a sin. It wasn't necessarily a sin, but it was if your behavior was sinful. And he had that line of thinking, but he also didn't think it was appropriate that I looked like a girl, I still hadn't developed facial hair at the age of 18, and though my voice had changed, so people perceived me as male. I was still had a very androgynous appearance, and he thought that was wrong. And the psychiatrist didn't seem too fond of that either. So in the hospital, I felt a lot of pressure. I felt a lot of pressure to conform, and I felt that if I told people I was having visions and talking to God, that they were going to never let me out of the nut house. So I left the psych ward. I cut my own hair with some scissors I stole from the occupational therapy room, which made a real mess. But then I had a barber come in and give me a real normal boy's haircut, and I went back to the priest, and he was good as word, and he gave me a free place to live for till I got readmitted to the school in September. And so I went to church every Sunday. I was living in a Catholic dorm. I finally met some Catholics. You know, I got out of the nut house, and I was laying low.
Back on Bridging the Bones with episode 2 of 2 of our interview with Jesse Clark. So you were saying that there was a kind of resurfacing of this sense of being transsexual or something like that, right? When you visited Father Larry.
Well, I as it were, confessed to him that that's what I was experiencing.
Though
It's
you
sort of an
weren't.
odd hybrid of counseling and confession. But, you know, I had been enjoying looking like a girl, and I was disappointed when my voice changed. But I was kind of coming to terms with it, but I would have rather have been a girl, but it wasn't a very feasible, realistic, or socially possible choice in the world that I actually lived in at the time. And so, you
This
know,
being mid 1970s.
yeah, I mean, there was a gay student movement on the campus, and I think I had come to the conclusion that I actually wasn't gay, but there wasn't a lot of terminology for what. You know, people called me a sissy and a faggot, so I was categorized as a queer person in the times because of the way I acted or looked. But after I got out of the hospital and had cut my hair, I had a lot of arguments with myself, and I kind of reconnected to my masculine side, and I sort of. It was social pressure, but also it was sort of internally. I wasn't really dedicated to the idea. And at the time, transsexuality meant that you got surgery. It was more about surgery than it was about hormones. You had to live as a woman for a year or more without any hormones in order to qualify for hormones. So anyway, I decided to become a man. And it was kind of fun. I kind of enjoyed being a man. When my facial hair came in, which I was about 21, when I started being able to grow a beard. So then I had a beard and I let my hair grow back out. And then I kind of looked like a Hasidic Jew because I had a very long beard and a very long curly hair. And then I found liberation theology, and that made sense. So now Catholicism made sense to me because it embraced my politics and it explained.
Wait a minute,
Not only.
liberation theology. I mean, that sounds like some kind of hipster brewery or something.
Well, the fact of it is, in 1970s, the church in South America was undergoing a true revolution, and the people were taking up arms and overthrowing dictatorships. So, in Nicaragua, they had it. The Cardinal brothers. There was Fernando and Ernesto Cardinal. It was like Philip and Dan Berrigan. It was two brothers who became priests, and they were very political, and they were doing grassroots education, and they were teaching political literacy using biblical texts and a Catholic framework, and that was a very large part of the base of the Nicaraguan Revolution. Something similar was happening in Brazil, but they were defeated by a fascist coup. Similar things were happening in Peru, and so there was a lot of armed struggle and religious, ideological conversation about what constituted liberation. And so generally speaking, liberation theology supported, quote, national liberation struggles, which.
Okay, but you were in the United States, you were in Maryland, and then you were back in New York, right? For
Yeah,
Columbia
I moved back
University.
to New York.
So then how did you get to liberation theology when that was most prominently in Central and South America?
Yeah, so for instance, I was an avid reader. I would read hundreds of books a year, and so I started reading liberation theology books from translations from South America, and there was an Episcopal priest at the school who was active in the liberation. Bill Starr, William Starr, he was the Episcopalian priest, and I continued my political orientation and activism. When Carter left office, Henry Kissinger lost his job, and he came looking for a job at Columbia University, and we drove him off campus. So that started up reactivating the student movement, and we created a divestment movement targeting South African investments, and Columbia University's board of directors' engagement with corporations that were directly aiding South African government, very much along the lines of contemporary boycotts of Israel. In fact, we're still, this is sort of the template, and we were one of the earlier groups. I had gone to Stanford for a visit when I went to California in the summer, and met some anti-apartheid activists, and we proposed to start a committee against investment in South Africa at Columbia University.
For divestment
Yeah, a
from
committee
South Africa.
against, it was called a committee against investment in
Oh,
South Africa.
investment.
Yeah,
Okay.
so it was a committee against investment, and we had a little socialist discussion group that we had, but there was not too many Catholics. The Catholics were really pretty conservative at that campus, and partly I think the university recruited conservative students as best they could to break up the student movement. So Bill Starr was someone who had tenure from the previous era as a chaplain of the school, so they couldn't fire him directly, and so he was preaching liberation theology as and he was preaching divestment from South Africa. And he had little pamphlets that he handed out, and he was the first one who like gave me a reading list, as it were, of liberation theology books. And so I was a big reader. I read the texts, and so it was a, and don't forget the revolutionary movements, and by 1978 or 79, the Nicaraguan rebels took over the government. So the wars in El Salvador and Guatemala and Nicaragua were underway already, and so it was the liberation movements were on one side, and the authoritarian fascist military was on the other side, and the Catholic Church had to choose sides, and they chose to side with the poor and the working people of and the peasants, not the whole church, but enough of the church that it became a big problem for reactionaries everywhere. So I was part of that movement. And so what happened was I an acquaintance of mine who was Catholic joined something called the Jesuit Volunteer Corps, and he got a placement in California doing community organizing in Emeryville. And I thought that was cool as shit. So I decided that my post-college career was to be a community organizer. So I applied to the Jesuit Volunteers. And then I moved to California. Then I met many active practicing liberation Catholics and people who were getting arrested at picket lines and people who were organizing solidarity and smuggling supplies and medical supplies to the rebels and protecting Guatemalan and Salvadoran refugees in the United States. And so it was a big social movement. We, and I continued to work on South Africa and divestment. In fact, the church that hired me was a big proponent of divestment. So then I was finally in a Catholic community that had the same ideas as I did. They had a real practice, and I looked like a guy and acted like a guy, so everything was rosy. I fell in love, I got married, and continued the divestment campaign. There was a thing called Stop Banking on Apartheid, which targeted the Bank of America. And so, we'd go in the bank and steal all the deposit slips and throw them up in the air and then run out of the bank. You know, eventually we got a lot of universities, including Columbia, to divest their stocks. We got the United States government to sign on to sanctions against the South African government. Got the United Nations condemning them, the ANC fighting them as guerrillas, and Oral's opinion made them a pariah, and they had needed external investments to keep the apartheid state running. And so they made a deal with the black nationalists that if they could continue capitalism, they would end apartheid.
As we're speaking, which is in this summer of 2025, there is a retrenchment of more conservative values around a lot of things. But one of the loudest voices, one of the loudest choruses seems to be regarding the awakening of a broader sense of what gender is. And so let me ask you, if a listener is skeptical, and I use the word skeptical because I think there's a strange parallel here. On the one hand, you're saying that you experienced something divine and you experienced God as a homeless dropout from Columbia while taking acid. And some people would hear that. I mean, some people would hear that and think, wow, well, that makes sense that they would that their mind would imagine God because they were raised within the Catholic sphere. So of course they would imagine God. And I think some people would take it further and also say, well, how do we know that Jesse didn't just imagine God, but that Jesse was imagining about not being a man?
You know, there are people like that. I mean, that thing about asserting that the reason that I saw God, as it were, was because I was Catholic. And so, you know, I actually had rather heated arguments with my atheist friends at the university, some of whom had taken acid and did not see God. So, but some of whom took acid and then became, you know, extremely religious, but not in the Catholic religion. So yes, the fact that I chose Catholicism was clearly a product of my upbringing. The fact that I became religious, I think, is just the natural element of human experience, and that religion is an important way of making sense of the world. But an organized religion has, you know, as most human institutions do, been co-opted and turned to another instrument for powerful people to have their way. The gender, the idea that there's a, I imagined I was a woman, is kind of funny.
Well,
Because really, the way I thought of it was that I was pretending to be a man, and so it was the thing that I was imagining was that I was a gender conforming person, when actually that had never really been my life experience, even from a young age. So, you know, and when the vocabulary of gender started to overtake the vocabulary of transsexualism. But mind you, in the 90s, I went to the Pacific Center, which is a gay rights, or it was a gay rights therapy center and somewhat activist meeting place for some parts of its existence. The transsexuals, when I went to those groups and talked about my identity, they said that I wasn't transsexual because I thought that gender could be performed, and that they believed that gender was an essential characteristic that was ordained from either before birth or at birth, and that transsexuals were people who should have been women, but somehow something went wrong, and now they're going to fix that by going to the doctor and getting female genitalia. So that was still the ideology of the transsexuals who I met in the 1990s. But and that didn't make a lot of sense to me because it didn't align with what I was experiencing. But by the early 2000s, the F to M members of the trans community
I'm sorry,
start
F to M?
the female to male transgender people which hadn't really been very prevalent in the trans spaces before, because there wasn't any surgery where you could change a vagina into a penis. So they began to experiment with becoming men, growing facial hair, taking testosterone, and socializing as men. And a lot of them realized that being having been many of them in the lesbian community as dykes or something along those lines, that it sucked. This the isolation and separation and confinement in male sex roles was stifling, and they began questioning the whole gender binary. And I think those people, when I met them in the early 2000s, I, oh, my people, finally, I found you, because they also believed that gender was complex and that there was more than two sexes. And because ironically, at the time in the 90s, transsexual people could have totally agreed with the pronouncement that there's only two sexes, men and women, and you have to be one or the other. And I, since I'm not a man, I am a woman. And that's, they believed in the gender binary with the same fervor that these reactionary, patriarchal, Christian fundamentalist, racist lunatics believe in. Because it's not a biological fact. It's not.
Let's take a brief break while we hear a word from this episode's sponsor. And we're back. This is Sertaline Wang interviewing our guest about their podcast and memoir, A Life in Stories by Jesse Clark. Available at the website radioreimagined.com beginning September 2025. What actually drove you away from the church? Or
Well, I stayed with it.
How did that relationship end?
Yeah, really. After, so I worked with the Jesuits and the Franciscans, or two religious orders that the Catholic Church has that are most leftist religious orders. And I started a collective print shop with the Catholic workers, where we did printing for leftist groups, and we worked with the big Catholic charity foundations in the Bay Area to agitate for social causes. And we were part of an ongoing group that met, and we didn't have catechism school, but we had study circles where we'd study Paulo Freire and other influential thinkers from South America, and we would meet visiting theologians at UC Berkeley and listen to their speeches. So I was involved, and then eventually I got a job at the St. Anthony Foundation as a community organizer in the Tenderloin, and organizing cultural and arts center. And so then I was really enmeshed, as actually paid by the Catholic Church. And I was I reported to a guy named Louis Vitale, who was the head of the Franciscan order in the Western United States, who reported to the head of the Franciscans in Rome, who reported to the Pope. So I like to say I was I reported to the guy who reported to the guy who reported to the Pope. I was only three steps away. So, I was really into it. I was Catholic. We did a Bible study group every week on Thursdays, and we read the Bible with homeless men, and we had, a revolutionary aspirations, and it was going pretty good then in the 90s.
Well, I'm a little confused. I mean, I guess I'm trying to reconcile your life experience within that direction of the Catholic Church, compared to the idea that more traditionally, like say during the French Revolution, that the church was evil and traditional and very much tied to the feudalistic land grabbing order of nobility and royalty.
Yeah, I mean, the Inquisition, the murdering of all the witches in Europe. There obviously were crimes against humanity that were committed and directed and organized by the Catholic Church, not to mention the role they played in the genocide of Native Americans, particularly on the west coast of the United States with the Francisco, with the whatever they call those people, going opening up all those missions where the enslaved Native Americans. I didn't have any, yeah, and murdering people. I did, although they wanted to save their souls, so they didn't want them to die. They wanted them to become baptized Christians,
Kill the
but
Indians, save the man, kind of thing.
something, yeah. So, just like you can be a United States citizen and completely disagree with the slavery, imperialism, the genocide of the Native Americans, but you're a United States citizen, so that's it. And so I was Catholic, and I was like, I'm Catholic. I was born Catholic. I was raised Catholic. I was believing Catholic, and I was married to a Catholic, and I liked being Catholic. It wasn't a problem for me. I wanted to change the Catholic Church. Unfortunately,
I'm
most
still a little
popes.
confused though, because I guess I'm still trying to reconcile what was the liberation theology movement. How do they reconcile their support of armed revolutionary slash insurgents with the teaching of the teachings of Jesus? Or how do they, I mean,
The Catholic.
how do they square the nonviolence of Jesus, I suppose,
Oh
with
well,
the ticking of
the
the
Catholic
clocks?
Church had already crossed that bridge, and they had a theory called the Just War. So, Catholic doctrine supports the use of armed violence to suppress a population. It's not that's been Catholic teaching for centuries. So the people supporting the armed revolutionaries didn't really have to convince the Catholic Church that killing people was wrong. They had to convince them that killing the rich was good. Anyway, finally, Ratzinger, the reactionary priests, bishops, and elected more and more conservative. Ratzinger came in, and
Well, we'll start with, I think, John Paul II, right?
right. I mean, he was retrenching it, but he was he promoted Ratzinger, who was a Nazi youth member in Germany, to head the Congregation of the Doctrine of the Faithful, or whatever it was called, which was the successor to the Inquisition. And he was that was the post he had before he became the Pope, and took the name Benedict, which was another strike against that name. So the purge that began with John Paul II was brought to fulfillment by Pope Benedict. And so then all those priests that were my colleagues and friends and co-workers, and they either got fired, or they had quit, or they got shot. The six Jesuits who got shot in El Salvador, or the four nuns that got raped and shot, or there was a lot of religious who were murdered. And then they were also kicked out of the church. They lost their institutional power. So the church began to purge them, and it took them a little while to get to San Francisco. But in the early 90s, a more conservative tendency took over the Franciscan leadership. They were more or less kind of Clinton corporate capitalist type people, but they were anti-liberation people. They kicked us out of St. Anthony's, but we already had a lease of a church building, and they couldn't evict us right away. So we survived for quite a few years. And I worked with the Tenderloin Reflection Center all that time. So, we
So so
lost. I
then,
mean, the
yeah.
leftists lost. And then around that same time, the pedophile scandal started to become public.
When you say about that time, you mean the late 90s?
Yeah, I
Okay.
mean, inside the Catholic Church, people knew that people were being accused of sexual molestation of children, and the progressives wanted those people fired and put in jail. But it took a long time for it to get to the wider public, and then it became, institutionally. Whatever, people probably familiar with the fact that it was rampant throughout many countries that priests were engaged in sexual abuse of children. So
And
that
was
was,
that one of the reasons why you left?
well, first off, everybody I respected either got fired or died. I mean, some of them held on. Father Louis held on, but you know, he was quite elderly and wasn't in charge of anything. Father Bill died. So, you know, you could say they left me. I didn't leave them. They went back to their old ways. They went back to the reactionary, murderous, pro-imperialist policies of their forebears. And then, not to mention, by that time, by the 90s, my ideas about gender and sexuality were under extreme revision. So, you know, I had come to the realization that I really, even though I enjoyed being a man, it really wasn't my natural state, and that it took a lot of conscious effort to cultivate a masculine identity that was expected of heterosexual men at the time.
So then, where are you with religion now?
Well, after that, well, track got we got gradually more marginalized, and the office moved into the YMCA, and divorced from the Catholic Church, and then the people who were in it became more secular, and it no longer had a revolutionary edge to it because there was no practical revolutionary movement that we could align ourselves with. And then I went, oh, I know, I got a job working with homeless people. I ha had become an editor at the Tenderloin Reflection Center, and you know, I believe in Jesus Christ. I believe in the resurrection of s saints, not in the body. I believe in a divine consciousness. I believe in justice, and I just haven't been able to find a community of believers that are also, you know, aligned with a lot of the other elements that are important to me.
Well, thank you for your time. Again, I'm speaking with Jesse Clark, who is releasing a new memoir titled A Life in Stories by Jesse Clark this September 2025. And this concludes our program. Bridging the Bones is an independent podcast free of influence from Fortune 500 corporations, governments, and political parties. You can find more episodes on our website, bridgingthebones.fyi. Much thanks to Andres Rodriguez for the use of his musical theme, El Llamado. This is your host, Sodaline Wang, signing off.